Hello.
Boo!
Now, there's no need for that.
Boo!
Oh, come on. Just because usual host Henry Hope Frost is off celebrating his birthday.
Boo!
Leaving me, Andrew Vandenberg, in the hot seat.
Boo!
There's no justification for behaving like a bunch of f***ing As you may have gathered, in this month, that's right, folks, we're now a regular monthly feature.
Boo!
Okay? This is getting really tiresome now. Anyway, joining me on today's pod, a magazine editor, Charles Bradley.
Hello.
Boo!
And news editor, Glenn Freeman.
Hello.
Boo!
And on that note, booing. After Sebastian Vettel's commanding win in Singapore, there were more boos. Guys, what's your theory on why this is happening?
I guess it's because no one likes him. I think he's created a slight rod for his own back, certainly from Malaysia, where he did make a mistake, and he fessed up to it. He did apologise for what happened in Malaysia. But I think majority of it is totally out of order, really. I think he's just doing the best job he can. But at the end of the day, people don't like a dominant winner, and they don't like somebody who they perceive to have an advantage over his teammate, which I think isn't the case. Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, he apologised to start with, but then he arrived at the next race. Was it Bahrain or China? And he sort of sat down on the Thursday and he took back all the apologies, which I don't think sat very well. But yeah, I think Charles is right. People are actually, they're booing him when actually they're booing the situation, which is that we've got the same guy winning all the time. But the thing about that confuses me is that the last German who won all the time, Michael Schumacher, is one of the most popular drivers ever. And he actually did some things on the track that would be worthy of booing.
That's what I don't get. What happened in Austria 2004... it's far worse in my mind than what happened in Malaysia 2002. Thank you for correcting me. All those seasons are so tedious, they all roll into one, and that's the point. Yeah, they were greeted as like they were a bastion of excellence.
It's not even really the team orders that I'm thinking of with Schumacher. It's driving into your opponents, creating a new sort of system of racing where you can put your brother practically in the pit wall as long as you make one move and stuff like that. You know, he moved the goalpost much like Ayrton Senna did before him, and he's hailed for it. And Sebastian's done nothing like that, really.
Going back to Malaysia, I think if the scenario had been replicated at the Lotus team, you'd have Romain Grosjean leading the race with Kimi Raikkonen steaming up behind. You'd heard there was going to be team orders, and then Kimi ignored them, overtook him, won the race. Everyone would be doing handstands rather than booing.
Also, I think if it was the other way around and Weber did it to Vettel.
Yep, that's what I was about to say. Weber would be considered some sort of hero going against the regime and stuff like that. But picking up on the boos again, which is where we started, I don't actually have a problem with it. I don't agree with it. But if people want to do that, if they care enough to have an opinion and they want to voice it, that's up to them. I mean, we all go to football matches. I'm going to my club this weekend, and a bit of booing for somebody is going to be the least of the concerns in the crowd. The sort of vitriol you get at football matches. It's a bit of pantomime, really.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's look back at the actual drive itself. Was it one of those ones we're going to look back and think that was a moment of absolute genius, a guy operating at the very top of his level? Or will it just be lost as a boring walkover?
I suspect it will be lost. There's not many dominant Michael Schumacher victories where he was perceived to have the best car. He probably did, but the same goes for Vettel. There is that perception. You don't recall those races. You recall the charges through the pack, the battles with Mika Hakkinen, or something crazy like the four-stop race in the French Grand Prix. You don't recall the ones where he won by 30, 40 seconds. Same goes for Nigel Mansell, Alain Prost, Ayrton Senna, and going back even further than that. It's very rare, maybe Jackie Stewart on the Nürburgring or something like that. It's very rare for a straightforward dominant victory to be remembered.
Yeah, I don't think we should underestimate it as purist, though. The way he pulled out those lap times on his first flying lap at the start and the restart after the safety car, he was 2.2 seconds a lap quicker than Nico Rosberg in a very competitive car. Absolutely amazing, I thought.
Yeah, and if you want to talk about people saying, oh, he's always got the best car, let's remember that Mark Webber's never finished second to him in a world championship, I don't think. But to pick up on one other thing about remembering Vettel victories and them being famous, let's not forget that Monza 08 is not held in the same regard as, say, Estoril 85 for Senna. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly the same to me. There's a guy announcing himself on the grand stage in tricky conditions, not in the best car, and wiping the floor with everyone.
Or even Monaco 84,
absolutely.
In wet conditions, taking full advantage of levelling the playing field.
But if you read any of the forums, they go, oh, yeah, but Bourdais was fourth on the grid, like 9 tenths behind. And as if he's some sort of Muppet, a four-time champ car winner. When I went to Surfers a few years ago when he drove in the V8s, he was easily the best of the European drivers that slotted into one of those incredibly difficult cars. You know, Bourdais was no Muppet.
Yeah, it's actually a bit of a regret, I think, from that race, is that Bourdais' car broke on the grid, because with the way the likes of Kovalainen in the better cars didn't put up much of a fight against Vettel, I'd love to have seen how Bourdais could have done. And who knows, Toro Rosso, otherwise the former Minardi team, could have had two cars on a podium that day.
And perceived wisdom says, oh, it was an Adrian Newey design car anyway. But then again, so aren't all the Toro Rossos in history been that, or certainly in recent history? And I don't see anyone else win a race in them.
Have they had a podium since?
No.
They've had nothing, have they, basically?
Absolutely not.
Okay, well, we've got Korea coming up this weekend. It's on a little bit earlier in the morning. I think it's a 7 a.m. start. Anything for our listeners to get up to watch, or another Vettel win?
Well, Glenn's normally the statistic expert when it comes to things like this, but I think Vettel's got a fantastic record at Korea, hasn't he?
He has, but I didn't actually look that up. But what I did look up is that last year, Korea was one of the few places where we had a Red Bull 1-2. So that clearly is a track where the Red Bull is usually dominant and probably will be again. Let's not forget in 2010 when Mark Webber threw away his world championship there. He's right on Vettel's tail as well. So he goes well there as well. The car, the whole package works well there. So, yeah, you talked about getting up at 7 a.m. It might be worth recording it if you've got a box that allows you to do that.
Certainly the first lap, I remember Vettel and Webber proper toe-to-toe into the first couple of corners. That would be quite nice to see again, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Webber was on pole last year and unsurprisingly Vettel beat him off the start. So it would be nice if anyone can put up a fight. And I'd like to see him and Webber go at it. Now we know that Vettel's pretty much got the championship in the bag and Webber's leaving. So I'd like to see them, you know, forget all the trying to be buddies or pretending to be buddies, shall we say. Let's see them go at it somewhere.
We had the announcement of next year's calendar, 22 races on it. What do we think about that? Is that just a bit overkill now, or can F1 handle that many events?
I thought in the sporting regulations there's not meant to be more than 20.
I thought they once said 18 was the maximum they would go to.
Money talks, doesn't it? But I remember being a kid, and I think, I don't know, around 94, 95, we went from 16 to 17 races, and I thought it was amazing. I thought, why don't you just race every week? But to be honest, I think it is oversaturation, particularly when a lot of these extra races are races you go into with no atmosphere. The fans don't care. They're tracks that just don't, in countries that don't have a culture. And I'm all for building a culture somewhere if you can. But most of these places you go, the people either don't care or they're priced out of even going to their first race. You know, we used to race in Turkey. I have a Turkish guy who cuts my hair and he tells me it's over a month's salary in Turkey, it used to be, to buy a ticket for the Grand Prix. That's not going to build a new culture in that country of racing.
No, I fully agree, but I think the only good thing is the races that are coming back. A return to Austria, there'll be a great atmosphere there. A return to Mexico, that'll be awesome, so long as Checo keeps his McLaren drive. Not convinced by Russia at all, and likewise New Jersey. Maybe we'll have 20 races after all.
Well, if we could maybe ditch Korea, that wouldn't be such a bad thing.
I actually think it wouldn't be a problem to have 20 or 22 races in a year if they were equally balanced through the season. You know, we're talking about, what is it, Monaco, New Jersey and Canada back-to-back, 3 weeks in a row. I mean, this season we had a huge gap in August, which we are meant to have, the summer shutdown. But because we didn't slot in an extra European race in July, we had a massive gap then as well. So we went about 2 months with two races, something like that.
We had the Hungarian Grand Prix in a seven-week period. That was all there
was. And how many races have we got at the end of this season with all these long-haul back-to-backs? It's something crazy, like six races in 9 weeks.
We have India and Abu Dhabi back-to-back because they're like next door to each other.
Yeah, you can practically get a coach, can't you?
Yeah, I think that's how they're getting it.
But you've got in NASCAR in America, you've got 36 rounds rather than, you know, the paltry 22. And they tend to reuse the same circuits. So, you know, as long as we don't go down that road, I think it's good to see the sort of global expansion of the sport, but I'd like to see a bit of quality control applied.
I think NASCAR's an interesting point because they're really struggling. The chase tracks aren't selling out. It's over last weekend. Masses of empty grandstand seats. So I think, you know, because the American economy is struggling, especially for your blue collar NASCAR types, people can't afford to go to their races, and they're a fraction of the price of an F1 event.
So they were not shutting down this weekend then?
Yeah, will they be able to run? There won't be any ambulances or anything, will they?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, that's enough of the F1. Outside of that, the first major championship of the season has been decided. with Ivan Muller winning another World Touring Car title. I think that's four now. He said it was his best ever. Why would he say that?
Well, I was as baffled as you as to why he said that. So I enlisted a bit of help from our World Touring Car correspondent, Sam Tremaine. And Sam had quite a good explanation, actually. He said, he likened it to Muhammad Ali. And stick with me on this. But Ali always used to say the hard work was in getting to the fight and getting ready for it. And the fight, essentially, for him was the easy bit. And the way that applies to Muller this year is that, you know, he lost his factory Chevrolet drive because they pulled out. And it was all the hard work he had to put in over the winter, getting a deal together, helping RML get money together. You know, he went and chased sponsors for the first time. And he took a lot of satisfaction from pulling that off and, you know, bringing Tom Chilton into the team, bringing some other big sponsors as well. He really played a key part in putting that package together. So when it's all come together and he's won the championship, with not masses of opposition on the track, it's still a real satisfaction for him because of all the things he had to do off the track to make it happen.
I mean, going back to what we were talking about Sebastian Vettel earlier, you know, the brilliance of him at the moment is that he is willing to keep putting the effort in. You know, it's going to be a fourth world championship for him as well this year. And, you know, you cannot underestimate how difficult that is to keep on top of your game and keep repeating that sort of excellence week in, week out. And that's what he does, that's what Muller does. And, you know, you have to just take your hat off to both of them.
Definitely. There's very few sports where you see people repeat dominance and victories year on year. People can come and go, but it's very, you know, it must be very hard once you've gone through all the sacrifice and effort to win it the first time, to just go away for a month or whatever in December and then come back and do it all again straight away. It sounds easy, and it feels easy when you play season after season on your PlayStation or your Xbox or something like that, but really finding the motivation, especially in elite sport now, it's so difficult to be right at the top of your game all the time. So the guys who do it in any sport, including our sport of racing, it's a phenomenal achievement.
And it's also in the same environment as well. When you look at someone like Sebastian Loeb, all those titles he's won with Citroën, Muller with Chevrolet, Sebastian Vettel with Red Bull, you know, just the fact that, you know, it creates that fantastic foundation, so it allows you to do it, but you've still got to nail it. Otherwise, Mark Webber, Tom Chilton, you know, all these other guys, all the teammates, Danny Sordo, Mick Hirvan, and whoever would be achieving the same things.
Yeah, I'm sure Fernando Alonso wishes Vettel would come back from one winter and not quite be up for it as much.
Yeah, quite.
Talking of winning it for the first time, last weekend Mike Rockenfeller won the DTM Championship. Both of you guys have covered that series in the past. How good is he?
Well, I first saw him in 2004 when he was doing German Porsche Cup, and I thought then, well, he'd make a good DTM driver. I think he looks really, really good. And since then, he went on to quite a few years in the DTM without achieving as much as you expect him to, but knowing that he was actually really good. And then going on Glenn would have covered him more than me in that period.
Yeah, I covered his rookie season in 2007. I think he got a podium in his second race or something like that. But the key thing for me really was that Rocky was part of this Audi youth generation push. He was in the first wave that they did around that time, and they got rid of some of their older names, some of their sports car names that they brought into the DTM. When Charles was covering it, and Charles knows that not many of those guys, I'd say anyone aside from Tom Christensen, really made a fist of it in a DTM. Mm. But you look at the guys they brought in, it was Rockenfeller, Lucas Lure, Alexander Premat. A year later, I think Oliver Jarvis came in. None of those other guys are still in the DTM. They all had their moments, but it's only Rockenfeller who's had the staying power. And he clearly showed a big commitment to the DTM, because as a Le Mans winner and as a driver with a good endurance heritage, even at his young age, he made a decision with Audi to focus on the DTM. You know, he's hardly done any sports car racing, I think, this year. And so that showed a great commitment to the DTM. That shows how much he put into it this year. And it paid off.
Well, he did very little since that Le Mans crash in 2011, didn't he? Who knows? That was a horrific crash. And it was almost... That reminded me of a situation when Tom Walkinshaw wouldn't let Wim Percy drive his Jaguars anymore, where Ulrich seemed to say, right, you're not going to touch these prototypes anymore. You're going back in the DTM. You're going to win that. You're going to focus on that. And that's exactly what he's done.
Yeah, I think it was quite a lot of Rockenfeller's decision as well. I know he said to our DTM man now, Jamie O'Leary, he said he looked at the age that guys can still achieve in sports cars. And, you know, you can do it up to 40 or even past 40, and he's not even 30 yet. So I think that played a part in his decision. It may have been that Ulrich suggested it to him as well. Mm. And he thought, well, I've got time. You know, I've got plenty of time to do sports cars, obviously providing Audi don't go anywhere. So let's dive into the DTM with both feet. And the DTM's such a hard series, such a professional series. You look at guys like David Coulthard and Ralf Schumacher, DC will admit you can't just rock up for 10 weekends a year and that'll be enough. It's a real, real top-level series. Pretty much a full grid of professional drivers, I think we'd all agree, and it's not to be taken lightly.
Now he's done it once, obviously, again with Phoenix, you know, doing a fantastic job. Can he do it again? Can he keep repeating? Can he become a 2-3-time champion, maybe, and become a real sort of German legend?
I first saw him when I was doing the BTCC in 2002 when he had a guest appearance in the Carrera Cup, and he won both races at Croft by a mile. I thought, I'm going to look out for him. it's taken a while, but he's got there.
Good spot.
Talking about other championships that have almost been decided, it's not quite all over in Formula Renault 3.5, but it was a big weekend for Magnussen's son, Kevin Glenn, over at Paul Ricard. Can you just explain what happened? Because it was quite a complicated situation.
Yeah, okay. I've got a headache just thinking about it. He dominated the weekend. He dominated both qualifying sessions and both races. However, after the first race, I think we'd gone about 4 or 5 hours, and his car still hadn't been released from Parc Fermé. And then shortly after, a lot of us had left the track, I got a message saying that he'd been thrown out. And it turns out, for the first time since the championship introduced DRS for the start of 2012, the Dams car checked post-race for its DRS, because Renault choose different things to check each time. And they've only checked the DRS once before, and Magnussen wasn't up there. They checked the DRS. The shape was slightly wrong on it, so they cut it open, and they found a layer of resin under the paint, which changed the shape and increased the torsion. Rather than the stiffness, there is a difference, I'm told. And that was perceived to give a gain. When the way the DRS works in World Series, rather than it opening up like you see in F1, it actually brings a little flap down to close the wing off so that the air can't get between all the slots. And if you increase the stiffness of that, which is what Dams had done, you reduce the chance of the flap opening at all at high load, so you create a perfect seal. That's not allowed to be done. It was much stiffer than a brand new one would be. So eventually they were thrown out. Dams, credit to them, have said, we've been doing this all the time and we keep asking for it to be checked. So there is an argument that they should be thrown out of every race that they've competed in since 2012. Fortunately, that didn't happen. So anyway, they were really angry with Renault because they tried so many times. I've seen the emails of them saying, come and check our cars, check everyone's car. And they even suggested that what they were doing should be banned, just for clarification, for clarity, so that something like this couldn't happen. And then to wrap it up, it galvanised the team. Magnussen galvanised the team the next day, and he was on pole by the same margin with a legal car, and he won by even greater distance the next day.
How good is he? Because he did that young driver test with McLaren in the summer, and apparently they were very impressed. Is he going to be able to get an F1 drive next year?
The talk seems to be that there's a very good chance of him being towards the back of the F1 grid next year. McLaren were really impressed with that young driver test, you're right, and a lot of it, Kevin's come on a lot, particularly in the last year. After the summer break last year, he said, oh, I'm too worried about setting the fastest lap every time I'm on the track, and I want to, you know, get pole and win every time. And he changed his mindset a bit, saying, right, well, it's not about every single lap that I do being the greatest lap ever. I've got to start building weekends. I've got to put a season together. So he backed things off at the end of last year, and then he coupled that with his speed at the start of this year, and the results have flown. And also, I'm told that at the first race, he wasn't getting on very well with his Dams engineers. He wasn't listening. So they had a word with his team boss, Jean-Paul Drio, who you two know very well. And I think Drio locked the garage door and had quite a stern word with him. And the result has been he's really looked like a complete driver this year. And it's been really interesting watching his development, actually. It's all too easy to see a guy who's got all the talent to start with, and they just move up the ladder in a sort of a straight curve, you could say. There's no such thing as a straight curve, is there?
Straight line?
Yeah, straight line. But yeah, anyway, he's got, I think he needs 7 points at the finale to win the championship. And his only rival, his fellow McLaren junior, Stoffel Vandoorne, has already said it's over. So he can have a bit of a coronation in Barcelona in a few weeks.
Charles is not quite all over in the BTCC, but Andrew Jordan looks like he's going to win it. You were there at Silverstone last weekend. Is he a worthy champion?
Yeah, I think so. The way he drove at Silverstone was fantastic, really. It was it's a power circuit, and because the Honda Civic that he drives has a zero differential boost, bar boost to its rivals, he was always going to be up against it there. But you know, he came away with a fantastic fight in second in race two. Used the soft tyre very intelligently, charged along, had a great fight with Jason Plato. Other good results all through the weekend, just basically enhanced his championship lead when he was expecting to actually lose out some points to some of his rivals. Okay, Jason Plato outscored him over the weekend, but it set him up very nicely to go into Brands Hatch and to hopefully be coronated as champion.
That series has been a bit of team dynamics, Triple Eight dominated for a while now. It's good to see a different team come in. You know, how are they operating at that level? Because they're quite a small team, really, aren't they?
They are compared to what they're up against. But, you know, Mike Jordan's Eurotech team, they've been around for a few years now. You know, they've got a really good heritage in the sport. I think Andrew himself's been, you know, an integral part of that. He's pushed them along. I think the development's come along. I think it's quite impressive the fact he's not got a stellar teammate in Jeff Smith. You know, he's a very sort of workmanlike driver, but he's not got somebody who can really, really push him along. But I think that the way he's outdone, you know, Matt Neal, Gordon Shedden, they're the benchmark in that championship. You know, for him to regularly outscore them and basically, you know, beat them to the championship, I think, you know, more power to his elbow.
I think it's great to see a new face winning, much like we had with Shedden before, to see the sort of Neal Plato duopoly being broken. And the great thing about Andy Jordan is we saw him come in as a kid from Rallycross and work his way up in that championship. You know, he's really learned his trade. He's been knocked off a few times by the veterans and stuff like that, and he's come back, he's rolled his sleeves up, and you know, he's turned himself into a really good top touring car driver. So you know, he clearly deserves it this year.
I think his mental attitude's, you know, second to none, really. He works with Autosport's resident mind coach Don McPherson, very, very hard on his game. And I think what he's added to that is big picture thinking, really. I think before he's always had the pace, but he'd be easy for him to blame bad luck on things and things not to go his way. But the way he's treated every weekend has been fantastic this year, and it's really pushed him on.
Looking forward to this weekend. We've got the WRC round in France, where the two great French rally drivers, Sébastien Ogier and Sébastien Loeb, will be going head-to-head. Ogier's basically won the championship. I think there's quite a very, very minuscule chance of him not winning, which I'm sure you'll point out, Glenn. But the thing I'm most interested about is seeing the two greats go head-to-head on a surface they both love and an event they're both desperate to win.
Yeah, well, I'll get to the specifics of the championship in a bit. But at first, let's just soak up the fact that these are the two greats of a generation. You know, the big shame for all of us, really, is that they didn't go head-to-head for longer. They had that one explosive season as teammates at Citroën. And, you know, this season's turned into a bit of an Ogier walkover with Volkswagen. But imagine if we'd seen VW led by their Frenchman up against Citroën led by its Frenchman in Loeb. I think that the interest in WRC would have gone through the roof this year. And it's a real shame that that couldn't come together. So, yeah, let's all make sure we follow it this weekend and soak it up. And I hope they really, you know, go at it, gloves off. And let's see what they can both do going flat out.
Glenn, can you just explain to us the way in which Ogier wins the WRC this weekend?
Yeah, it's a little bit confusing for something that appears to be such a formality. But there's a point on offer on Thursday night of the event. So depending on when this podcast comes out, that point's either up for grabs tonight or has been decided yesterday, probably. But it's not so much about whether Ogier can get that point, because you have to make the finish of the rally, I believe, to be eligible for it. But if his main rival, Thierry Neuville, doesn't get that point, then there are not enough points left in the season for him to overhaul Ogier. So it can be decided in the first stage. And to be honest, for the good of the fight between the two Sebastians, we need it to be decided so neither of them have anything to lose and they can really go at it on home soil.
Yeah, it would have been a real sort of Richard Burns, Colin McRae style rivalry, wouldn't it, if we'd seen them go head-to-head for years. But how do we think that, you know, Volkswagen versus Citroën at the moment? It seems like Volkswagen have the upper hand, don't they?
Yeah, I think they've probably invested a lot more in it. We know that when Volkswagen does motorsport, be it Dakar or Formula 3 or anything else, you know, they don't go about it sort of, they don't do it half-hearted. But I think this year, the Citroen investment is going down every year. I think they were able to sort of rest on their laurels a bit with Loeb wiping the floor of everyone for a while, and Ford's commitment to M Sport going down all the time. Now they've come up against a proper, fully fledged manufacturer entry, and they've been caught short without their star man.
Well, I think that's the point, though. I think we'll see how quick that car really is this weekend.
True.
I say no disrespect to Evan and the Sordo, but it's sort of implicit disrespect to them. I don't think they're good enough or quick enough to take the fight to Ogier on a regular basis, and that's been proven this season.
Well, the way I see it, if our rally man David Evans has lost patience with those two, then I think it's fair enough for the rest of us to as well.
Loeb won his first FIA GT feature race at the weekend. Do we think he's ready for circuit racing in his World Touring Car Challenge with Citroën next year?
Well, I think if Van Muller is about as hard an opposition as he's going to have, there'll be no doubt about the benchmark there. I think it's going to be fascinating. I think it's going to take a little while, but as you say, you know, he's shown in GTs that he's got the sealed surface road course pace, so yeah, why not? And certainly he'll have the backing of the team, we know that for sure.
Yeah, and let's not forget that, you know, he's been circuit racing since he dallied in Le Mans with Pescarolo. When did he finish second there? 2006 or 2007?
Yeah, 2006, wasn't it?
Yeah. So he's been putting a toe in the water for a little while, and he's properly jumped in this year. And by all accounts, people that have worked with him and stuff like that say his thirst for knowledge and how quickly he learns is phenomenal. So he does appear to be genuinely getting the hang of circuit racing. So that'll be fascinating next year.
If they put Kubica in that car next year, I think World Touring cars, there might only be 9 full-spec cars on the grid, but it'll be one of the most fascinating championships to watch.
Yeah, that dynamic will be amazing, won't it?
Yeah, I think at best Kubica will get 2 or 3 races by the sounds of it. And even that's only if he signs a deal to rally with Citroën next year, which he hasn't yet. You know, there's plenty of talk of Mercedes sniffing around him for a DTM drive at the moment, which could ruin all of these plans.
Well, that's almost it. But this weekend we've got AutoGP, the series finale at Brno, IndyCar back around the streets of Houston, where they got Indy Lights as well, which I think there's 4 or 5 drivers still in the championship fight there.
That's probably 4 or 5 cars in the race.
I think that's every car that's in it can win the championship. And the is it the last ever ALMS race or one of the last ever?
No,
I should have done my research on this.
Petit Le Bon in October the 20th.
The championship's already been won, hasn't it? Anyway, ALMS, swan song coming towards an end. Anyone got anything to add on that?
I'm fascinated by AutoGP. You've got Vittorio Gerelli, Sergio Campana, Naren Carfake and Kimi Sato. Four drivers looking at that championship this weekend. Should be quite fascinating. And then, you know, Glenn IndyCar around Houston, there's quite a fascinating title battle going on there too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good to see IndyCar going back to somewhere like Houston where it's got a bit of heritage and where it used to go in its heyday. But obviously the big news coming out of IndyCar this week was the reveal of the details of the Indianapolis road course race. It's by no means taking place on the F1 or even the MotoGP track, I think, if you look at the specifics. But the huge talking point is the fact that the month of May, which is now really the fortnight of May, actually has 2 races at Indianapolis. And there's been a big argument from some who are steeped in the history of the sport saying that, you know, May at Indianapolis should be sacred for the 500. You guys have both been there. I've been there. What do you think about opening May at Indianapolis with a road course race?
Well, the Indy press room is one of the world's most bitter places. Even now, it's still full of people that are stuck in 1995 in the pre-split era that refused to get over
it. Great
season. Oh, fantastic. But the old school thinking there and the just ingrained bitterness is quite amusing to see. And the general vibe come from there was, if they can't sell out all the tickets at Indy for one race, how are they going to do it for two? And actually, there's a bit of logic in that that I sort of agree with. And I don't see how diluting it is going to make the event better.
I hate to disagree with AJ Foyt, who said that any other event in the month of May would dilute it, but I do disagree with him. I'm sorry. I think it's a great idea. I think just to kickstart that whole month and to try and get the fever back into the place, to try and bring the fans back into the practice days. I used to watch it in the mid-90s, very early days of live streaming. They'd show all the practice days. They'd be running every day after day. There'd be fans in the grandstand. You know, it was such an incredible event.
Yeah, if you're going to look at the positive for it, if you're going to pin your hopes on something, you'd hope that it's a bigger way of kicking off the proceedings at Indy. Because, yeah, what is it, a week of practice, then pole day, and then a week building up to the race. And it does seem that, as I say, it used to be the month of May, but it seems to have lost a lot of its verve at the moment. So if a road course race can bring some of that back, then I'm all for it. But part of me thinks that maybe it shouldn't have been around the time of the 500.
Just going back to the actual layout of the course that they're going to use, quite interesting to see they've got a chicane before the final corner of the old Formula One track, which obviously was where all the problems were that led to 2005 being such a debacle. And I guess that the track would be eligible for FIA Grade 1, so it could actually host a Grand Prix again one day.
On Michelin tyres.
Well, on Pirelli tyres. So that would be quite an interesting gambit, wouldn't it?
Well, like the drawn-out end to the 2013 F1 season, we've been going on for far too long. Thank you, Charles.
Bye.
Boo!
And Glenn.
Boo.
Boo!
And for you for listening, I'm assured that Henry will be back for the next one in November, and that's a lap.
Boo!